Ronan would like to forward the belief that peace and justice in Israel and Palestine will result from the activities of committed people struggling in many different areas for political, social, and environmental change. So let us welcome Ronan Edelman.
Hi, and thanks for inviting me. When I decided to come to the U.S., I wanted to come and talk to people, but it wasn't really clear. Like, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to say. I just knew it was. I had this feeling that it's very important to have this dialogue, especially with the what you would call the peace activists. Both the Jewish groups and the public, you know, the all public groups, to create this dialogue, because I felt it was really wasn't really happening with groups in Israel. And I had many messages I wanted to pass in this dialogue, but as time went by, and as you know, Seattle's for a lot of people the last stop, and it's also the second to last stop for me, so I. In a lot of cities already, the message became very clear. And I mean, it's a very simple message. It's a message that you could be pro-Israel and not be pro its policy. What happens that the message is so simple, but for some reason nobody could get it. And it's so surprising. It's like, I'm Israeli. I'm proud that I'm Israeli. I'm not proud of what my government is doing. I'm not proud about lots of things that have been going on since the creation of Israel. But it doesn't mean I'm not pro-Israel, because I live there, and I want my future there. And being pro-Israel is being pro-Palestinian for the same reason. And that's also, if you're pro-Palestinian, you can't be pro the destruction of Israel, because that won't work either. And being pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel, or being pro-people, basically, is being, you know, it's finding the people who share the same values that I assume the people in this room have, that work both on the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, and see how we can work them and support those people. But and also be very critical of the people on both sides that don't support these values. It's a very hard task. It's very hard knowing lots of times on who to support from which side. And that's why you have to be educated, and we have to educate ourselves. And that, I think, the media has a lot of, is very important in that. And I've been working in different groups over the years, and 2 years ago, most of my focus went into media work, and this comes from this understanding that this is might be the most important place for an activist to be today is working in media. It's getting this information out. It's, you know, in Israel, there's this, I don't want there that in 20 years somebody could say, I didn't know. That won't be an excuse. You know, we have to, and we're working on the Israeli public. Most of the stuff, 90% of the things we do are in Hebrew. You know, we're not out there to, there's many groups that are bringing out the word, and there's many internationals that are coming, and I know there's people from the IMC here in Seattle that were in the territories and came back with movies, and that's a very important group, very important. But it's for me, it's the most important to talk to Israelis. That's why it's kind of weird for me to be here, because I'm not talking to Israelis right away. But that's the work we're doing. So in indie media, at the moment, we've been we have four main projects that go on all the time, and then there's many other projects that I could talk about later. The first one is the internet site, which, if you're familiar with indie media, is pretty similar in all indie medias. It's an open publishing, meaning that anybody could go on and post news, comment to other people's things. And this is especially important that it's a place where people could voice what they have to say. They could even do it without saying who they are, which is very important in our area. And it creates a dialogue between people that oftentimes don't even meet. because there is dialogue happening on the website. And it's so important, this opening publishing, which of course has lots of problems, because a lot of annoying people, a lot of stupid people, a lot of people that are even dangerous also take advantage of this. But, you know, this price to pay for the open publishing is, it's a high price to pay, but it would be a much higher price to pay, I feel, if voices, people felt that their voice is not heard, and they wouldn't have this platform. The Internet Project is mostly, again, in Hebrew, but there's also an option to use Arabic, and, of course, there's also the English option. Hopefully, in the future, we'll also have, and we're working on it, a Russian option, which there's a very big Russian community in Israel. What we're going to watch now is a video from the video group. They show their videos in public screenings and also on community television. It's not the... And the movie we're going to see is a magazine that was filmed in April. And it pretty much deals with the occupation, because that was when the Israeli forces re-entered the territories and the Palestinian towns. But what you'll see here, it's very much from the Israeli perspective, from the Israeli activist perspective, because this was made for the Israeli public. And you have to remember this when you're watching this. This is made for the Israeli public. This is we had to take this to court in order to be shown, but it was shown at the end, and it was shown many times. Since this has been made, over 6 hours already of other stuff have been shown after we were able to win it in the courts and have it open that you could show this stuff on community television. Their claim was basically that community television is not for political movies. Our claim was that everything is political. And if you say you can't show something political in Israel, it means that you can't show anything. So, at the end, we made them change their decision after we took it to court, that you can't show something that's linked to a political party or is funded by a political party. And of course, we're independent media. We are not linked to any political party, and we don't get funds from any political party or from, of course, any corporation. So, which, because it can't be commercial either. So that that was one of the reasons. That's how we won. We were able to show it. We have a print team. We put out a magazine. Comes out every other month, 6 times a year. There's copies that you could look at after. It's in Hebrew, but there's also a lot of good graphics and art, and which is also very important to have in the work we're doing, to be also creative, to have music, to have art. And there is a team working on radio, which at the moment is through it's community radio, also working a lot with the neighborhood where our center is. At the moment, for the internet, we are working to see how we could also work with the law or not, you know, because, and have it through FM, which is very problematic now. Not that we have a problem breaking the law, it's just our stuff would be confiscated. And you'll see what I mean by breaking the law soon. So we'll start with the video. I'm sure a lot of questions will arise from that, and we'll do that. Now, it's mostly in Hebrew. There's subtitles, and it's not only always clear. So first of all, I suggest that you could come a bit closer even, and I'll try to read some of the stuff over with the microphone, because I kind of know it by heart already, and so things will be clearer.
You want the lights off?
Yeah, I think that'd be the best. And if people are really really confused, which happens sometimes, because again, this is made for the Israeli public, it's okay, we could stop it and make things clear and continue, because we're not a big group. So feel free to stop it if you feel a need. Yeah, we could do the lights.
Should we just say stop?
Or yes, I guess.
Oh.
Well, this is a siren that is sounded in Israel on Memorial Days. So it was pretty symbolic that we showed it on footage from, this is footage from Bethlehem in April, after the Israeli troops were in Bethlehem. This was filmed by indie media people from Italy, because we weren't able to go in then, and as internationals it was easier for them to be there. I'll do a voiceover when they start speaking, but I see it's really small.
Where did you say this is?
Bethlehem.
Bethlehem.
And the siren is in Bethlehem?
No, this is just from the editing. We put the siren, so to make it more dramatic.
They re-entered Bethlehem this week? They re-entered Bethlehem this week?
Yeah, but this is from April. On Memorial Days, like memory for dead soldiers or for the Holocaust. As I understand it, Sharon is moving towards a situation of no choice. It's a self-realizing prediction. He's leading us to a situation where the war of tribes doesn't leave any room for a voice of hope. He's not really asking to draft us into some alternative dream, a new Eastern Mediterranean, new and a half of Shimon Peres, or a new order in the Eastern Mediterranean. He's asking to draft us into the politics of despair. He isn't trying to do this with a vision, but with bombs. It's clear in the past month that any attempt to stop the decline brought an Israeli provocation that brought terror. People see their loved ones dying in the streets. Prepared to demonize the other side, they agree on the next military step. This whirlpool is turning us not into wardens and prisoners, like Leibovitz said in 67, but into murderers and murdered.
Is that an Israeli speaking?
Yes. The Oslo process may be for part of the Israeli elite really symbolize an attempt to ending the occupation. But at least for a different part, and maybe without even the two agreeing on it, it was an attempt to modernize the occupation. Finding a second contractor in the form of the Palestinian Authority will keep things quiet and will keep living like the occupation is over. It never ended, and the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority was, of course, full of contradictions from the start. It was clear from the start that they wouldn't be able to fit the position without losing legitimacy. And if it wouldn't fulfill a position, it would receive criticism from the Israeli side. This is a demonstration from the U.S. Embassy. There is this myth in this country, in Israel, that the good old Uncle Sam will come one time and make peace. This and care for everyone. This culture boy that has no connection with the depression of the blacks or racism in American society and not the American control of the third world. It's like a popular folktale that is told in Israel. America doesn't support Israel because of the Jewish lobby or the love of Mordechai, but because it's willing to sacrifice our lives here in, to keep their interests in the Eastern Mediterranean. I think the Americans play a despicable role and are ashamed as a world leader. And we must put a contra to the rights rule of AIPAC and to another and to the Israeli lobby in the United States. It's much easier to convince the majority in Israel than the U.S. government. If we want peace, we're not Israeli politicians. We don't have to make peace with Capitol Hill. We have to make peace with East Jerusalem and to the residents of the Eastern Mediterranean. This is a food convoy entering Jenin when it was under siege. Basic food supplies arranged by a group called Tayush. Tayush is an Israeli Arab activist organization. It's not a coexistent, not a place where you drink coffee and eat hummus. It's a place where Jews and Arabs try to build from below solidarity. To tear down the walls between us, within the Israeli society, and sway the larger wall of wire fences. the whole action prepares a bridge of solidarity because it's based on cooperation. The Jewish members of Tayush depend on in the territories on their Arab friends. And every Arab member, when the police and border police get near, are dependent on solidarity from the Jewish members around him. The group tries to create an interaction that demonstrates how a shared life of Jews and Arabs would look like without oppression. In the settlement West Bank, in the southern West Bank, there are several villages that each with tens of Palestinian families that live in caves and huts. They support themselves by keeping livestock and farming. It's now 3 or 4 years that there's a systematic step after step by the settlers, the IDF, and the civilian management trying to evict the residents of southern Mount Hebron. It's establishing settlements, confiscating land, blocking wells, and demolishing houses, and in certain cases, loading them on trucks and threatening them on gunpoint with deportation to Yatta. Yatta is the village in the next region next to it. I just started it now from nothing, from zero. After a public struggle, the Supreme Court filed an order to return the residents home. The following day, 120 additional families were evicted. Stop the transfer. Even though past caravans were stopped, the army and police, by army and police, a Tayush convoy was set off to the area to bring blankets and food to the people living there. Ten o'clock, first stop. Good morning, people. You're about to enter the district of Judea and Samaria. I'm asking you to wait together. We'll figure out what you're doing and come to a decision. Captain Amnon. Any sort of situation begins where you disturb the peace, or if someone else will disturb the peace, the public is endangered, I'll ask you to evacuate the area and retrace your path. Is this matter clear to us? 10:30, second stop. Let's start from the beginning, okay? You're now in a closed military zone. We have a problem with you going in, up to there. It's a Tayush convoy. 11:30, third step. I'm asking you to not make problems and to let the security forces pass. You can't clear them out in 10 minutes. My guess is that even if you don't want to get close to the settlers, chances you will. The settlers are blocking the road. Hello, everyone. This minute, the settlers parked their cars and the road has been closed. 45 minutes that the army and police together, although they're giving them tickets, they are unsuccessful in getting tow trucks here. There's no tow trucks in the area that could arrive? I don't have to answer you. Company Commander Dror. We're now allowing the caravan delivering food and blankets to continue northwards. The road is open. But, a minute. It's a closed military zone. In other words, we'll gather together because we can make it there. Stay together, and it's very important that we keep the actions principle of nonviolence. Good afternoon, folks. Could I say a few words? This is the captain speaking. Ken, yes. All the agreements we've already were broken by you. The authorities in the field decided this minute that the area declared a closed military zone. You close yourself in a statement that applies directly to court necessities. You waited for a provocation, and instead of clearing the settlers for an hour, you took your time and broke all agreements. That's my interpretation. I'm not allowing you to pass. There's an IDF representative who's in control here. And I, as a police captain, announced that I'm giving you 15 minutes, allowing you to go back where you came from. To this side, you can't go. To this side, you can't. To this side, you can't. Only to that side. And I'm asking. Stop the occupation. Come on, arrest people. Come on, arrest people. Back. I'm not touching. I'm yelling. We've reached an agreement with the army and the police that will continue from the side here to bring the blankets and avoid confrontation with the settlers. But we have terms. Our terms is that they release the arrestees. I decided to release the arrestees. The police and military show a caravan alternative route so they won't meet the settlers, but effectively lead them into confrontation. There's something I'm proud of after a year and a half of action that the families are still in the land. It's already over 2 years now. They suffer abuse from settlers. The army still bothers them, but they're still there. Thank you and to everyone who helped us. We're sorry that the day is too short. It wasn't good of them to hold you for 3 and 4 hours. It's illegal. Where did you come from? The main road? Yes. But no one is allowed in here. It's forbidden. It's a firing zone. But we have nowhere to go. This whole story, supposedly, of the Zionist ideas, I don't really know who still thinks about it. But it's minimum Arabs and minimum land, and maximum Jews on maximum land. Eviction of Arab residents from Sheikh Jarrah's neighborhood in East Jerusalem by hundreds of border police. 10 of settlers led by Knesset member Benny Alon entered the evacuated home. By the way, he's already a minister now. Benny Alon, they promoted him. Okay, I don't want to dispair you with force, but I ask you to go there. There are people in the houses. Everyone will leave the apartment and wait for the lawyer. Okay, no problem. A few minutes and he's here. I don't have a problem. In the meanwhile, you go over there. This is in East Jerusalem. It's impossible to transfer 250 million Arabs and Muslims in this area. People don't understand that they live in the Eastern Mediterranean. Their racism, their cultural and political gutter, the ghetto that they enforce on themselves and everyone. It's a ghetto that doesn't let them understand that there's no transfer. It's impossible to do it. They can make a community from here to there for 3 years, for 20 years. So instead of a man blowing himself in Tel Aviv, he'll blow himself up in a synagogue in Paris. Here in Israel, people don't want to learn. People who live in the Eastern Mediterranean don't want to understand that they live in this place. What can I tell you? So he'll move the border from here to there and another 250,000 Arabs. So what? He's not in the Eastern Mediterranean? He's not in the area of Islam? And Saddam Hussein can't send missiles from Baghdad? Go up, what happened? Now I want the commander, the one who hit me, I want him. This is a Palestinian from East Jerusalem talking. It doesn't matter today if I will die or if you give me a bullet. It doesn't matter. I want him. I live here. I'm living with my mother in Edouard. I have nothing to lose. I've lost a lot. Congratulations, tell him. Tell him to send my regards. Congratulations. It's about time they come out with a message of how we fit in the Eastern Mediterranean, which a different message then will give it to them. We'll put them in jails. We'll arrest. and will assassinate. Israel's feeling of power is misleading because the other side people feel much stronger. From feeling they have nothing to lose, they're very powerful. You're scared when you have something to lose. When you have a villa, a Volvo, a job, a wage, a mortgage, you're scared to lose them. They don't have that. They're not scared. You go into the territories frustrated, to the refugee camps, and come out stronger. This is a closed military zone. We'll use any means against anyone trying to go by. We ask you to evacuate the area. This demonstration is a legal protest. I agree this area is declared a closed military zone. People negative and after Land Day were arrested for incitement. In Lod, a police captain decided that a quiet gathering of 14 people is illegal and stated before him that a gathering of more than 3 people is a legal gathering. He put them in jail for a night and then house arrest. All these are signs that there is a justified attempt to silence people, but that's nothing compared to what's going on in the territories, and it shouldn't be a good reason to keep quiet. We still have a large room for democratic action in this country. Our problem is not that it is closed, but we don't use it for street actions and do demonstrations. Two countries for two people, Israel and Palestine. Occupation, no. Peace, yes. Around checkpoint, second pass over. Arab Jewish woman march leads towards the checkpoint where to bring also food and supplies to siege Ramallah. It's a march led by women, both Arab and Jewish. After negotiation, the first truck passes. Today a truck, the songs are on the way. That's what they're singing. Food on the other trucks is passed by hand because they didn't let the other trucks in. They only let one truck. More than 20 demonstrators were evacuated because they were hurt from tear gas and shock grenades.
Where is this now?
It's between Jerusalem and Ramallah, the entrance, the checkpoint entering Ramallah. No, no, it won't pass the fascism, it won't pass. After the activists were despaired, 4 aid trucks passed the checkpoint. After 2 days' delay, the aid was distributed in Ramallah, ironically with the help of 7 Israeli women activists. It was important to show us in Aram that we won't be able to pass the card. It was a non-violent... Wait, let me... I lost this for a minute. 1 second. So at the end, the food supplies were dispersed around Ramallah by 7 women Israeli activists. It was important to show us in Aram, where we brought thousands of people in 4 trucks, that we won't pass the checkpoint in peace. This demonstration was a non-violent. It must be stopped. They must deter it. Stop this way of protest. I believe this is the best way to protest. And our question is exactly how to widen it. Not by a big rhetoric of a figure, but by the help of bringing the majority into these actions. We won't kill or be killed in the service of Zionism. This is a demonstration in central Tel Aviv. This small group walking into the demonstration is a queer group against occupation. This government in our name is making terror. And we, the fighting peace activists, knew closely many of those eliminated in the name of security. Tell me, what is enlightened about this occupation? This occupation is ruinous. Yes, it's destructing all of us. A soldier gets to the territories and sees a dreadful, threatening reality. Thousands and thousands of people in horrible reality, in poverty, part of them hungry, humiliated. This is Ishai Rosenzweig, the conscientious objector. And then he gets the order, and you realize that your whole role is to bring them into poverty and to degrade them more and more and more and more, deeper, deeper, and deeper. To stop them from going out, working, making a living, to take every possibility of normal life away. And then two things happen. First of all, if there's any humility left in you, you hold your hands in your head and ask, God, what is happening here? What are they demanding me to do? How did I get to this? How did they manipulate me? How did they lie? They told me these stories of no choice, and we didn't start, and a nation for peace. And guarding security, and guarding settlements, this whole rhetoric, this subtle rhetoric that spun us. Fighting terror? You're joking with us. This government is a seabed of terrorism. And this army policy is a seabed for terrorism. Some things are forbidden. It is forbidden to starve people. It's forbidden to humiliate them. It's forbidden to stop their movement. It's forbidden to treat men, women, and infants like dust. It's forbidden, forbidden, forbidden. And the more people realize this, the quicker we'll be finished with this terrible occupation. It's in our hands. They say the refusers are confused, and we say the opposite. They are the conscious and the compass. They say the refusers are lawbreakers, and we say the refusers are the real Democrats. Fuad, Minister of Defense, how many kids did you kill until today? People, this occupation is funded by our tax. The apartheid is supported from our tax money, your tax money also. The sniper courses and the bulldozer driving lessons are funded by our tax money. We want these money to go to a sane Israel. One for equal social programs, for health, for work, and for education. For a just division of land between Jews and Arabs, Ashkenazim and Mizrahim, between rich and poor. To this left and to this government, we say we are all war refusers. There's a great power not in just the numbers of refuseniks, in the fact that 32 are in military jails. There's much more today. And that Yesh Gvul and the new refusers letter are taking off. But a quarter of the population supports the refusers. That means that we are successful in doing something against the occupation, as well as contributing to the democratization of the Israeli society. and putting the blood, the act of blindly fulfilling orders to Ritesh, to show that people can stop acting like robots and, or soldiers and killing machines. We could say no. And I love them. If you see us make a sign, jump. We'll know if you see. This is in front of the jail where they put the people who refuse. And people go there every weekend and show solidarity. Israeli society hasn't even started to deal with the occupation. It hasn't even begun to big argument with the settlers. Haven't removed one settlement. Do we want to be a settling society? Not a Wild West, but a Wild East, a sort of border that advances all the times. Or we say, enough. We have a future in the Eastern Mediterranean, only if we live in it as equals, inside its world. It could be nice, no? Someday we could be free people. Really free. We could move around the country, not as settlers, but live inside this vast Arab area to enjoy its culture and to contribute to it. It'd be a huge thing, no?
Who is the narrator there?
The narrator, his name is Gadi Afghazi. He's one of the founding members of Tayush, which is the group we saw here, and I could talk more about Tayush if you're interested. He was also a refuser in the 80s to the Lebanon War, so he's talking us out of experience. And he's a great person. But one of the, I think one of the great things about Tayush, that there's many, many leaders. And in the movement at all, also in Indie Media, and in Black Laundry, and in many, many groups, that it's really, it's hard to point at one person, not because there isn't a leader, just because there's a lot of great people taking roles of leadership. If in the past you're able to talk about Tayush, now I think it's more, it's better to say Tayushes, because there's many, many groups that are working as Tayush, which means Arabs and Jews working together in solidarity, and, you know, naturally being working together, not because there's some kind of, you know, law saying it has to be 50-50, but because if you want to do the work, you know, the Arabs could do certain things because they have their connections in the territories, they know the language, they're there. And the Israeli Jews could do certain things because their approach to media, because they have different facilities. I mean, it works. It works as a group. Everybody bringing what they could bring, and then there's many groups who are working as Tayush, working on different projects. I write in sometimes the calendar in Indie Media what's going on. I have to call like 7-8 different people just to figure out, you know, how many, you know, what Tayush are planning next week. And I found myself in the past months literally being in the territories almost every weekend, doing, sometimes it was humanitarian work, sometimes it was demonstrations, sometimes it was meeting Palestinians for dialogue. I mean, it's very, very diverse, but it's definitely political work. It's not just like Gadi was saying, we don't sit around drinking coffee and eating hummus, which that we do after. okay, did maybe someone want to help me with the... taking questions and all that, so I won't like miss people and okay.
Are you ready to?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Okay. Jeff.
It looks to me like you need a third party to come in between the two groups of people, if you don't mind a naive suggestion. I mean, I'm sure it's not original. What about the UN and the DMZ between the two countries?
I think the international community has a very important role. But we have to solve it between ourselves.
Why can't you get a third, the United Nations with a demilitarized zone?
Because we live together. We're living in the same region. You know, every time, I don't think it's, you know, people who are in conflict have to solve their conflict. By building a big wall in between them, then, you know, it doesn't solve anything. So how, so you just, you'll build a bigger wall and a bigger wall and a bigger wall, you know, and... I mean, I grew up in Jerusalem. I can't imagine a wall going straight down Jerusalem. I want to live with them as neighbors, as equals in Jerusalem. That's my goal.
It looks like it's not working.
Okay, I mean, that is a problem. Who said, okay, do you think a wall... I think a wall will bring more hatred. Will be much worse. I'm not a big believer in the UN either. I mean, I think as... internationals, as with who come... to work with the people, people who are concerned and don't have different interests of representing governments and corporations and all that, like was in the past, then they could, there's a good role for them. But well, I don't trust the UN. The UN was they're representing interests that are not in the interest of the people, not of the Israeli people, not of the Palestinian, for sure not the Palestinian people. The UN represents governments that are oppressing their people in the Arab countries, in Israel, and in this country also. Okay. Yes.
Makes
no sense.
Just point.
Yeah. Okay.
Are Europeans who come to help in terms of getting the convoys through? Are there a number of them coming? Are there any of them coming? And how does the Israeli military respond to, for example, European?
There's hundreds of Europeans, also North Americans, and a few also from Japan and other places that are coming and doing great work. You know, many, many different kinds of work. You know, there's people who are teaching art to children in the refugee camps. There are people who are driving ambulances. There are people who are bringing in, walking with people to soldiers and trying to get their papers back. You know, there's many, many things that the internationals could do, and they do, a lot of them do a great job. But there's many things that the internationals can't do, and us as Israelis, we could do. First of all, we could talk to the Israeli public. And hope, I think, for the Palestinians will come from when there's a shift in the Israeli public. And I believe it's still possible. It's very hard. Every day I'm becoming less optimistic, but I didn't lose it completely. I still think we can make the shift because we were there before. We were there. And it means that deep inside, the people are willing to it. They're just scared. And I would hope also a lot of the internationals would also help us doing that also, in solidarity with us, and not forget. Because there are two sides. You know, and we have to remember, it has to be solved between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It's not the Palestinians can't, just like Israelis, you know, politicians, you know, want, you know, like Jaffa was saying, you know, they're doing peace with Capitol Hills, they're forgetting who they have to do peace with. It can't be that on the Palestinian side either, you know. And they don't really have peace with Capitol Hill either, so maybe, you know, we could bring the hope. Yes?
You said that you go in and speak to the Palestinian people, is that correct?
I speak to many different Palestinians, yes.
Would you feel comfortable showing a film like this to them, to show them how many people are really...
Oh, of course.
I have you shown it.
Yes, we've even talked to we sent a copy to Al Jazeera, hoping that they would say. The Palestinians are very interested in this. They want to know. Every refuser that goes into jail gives hope to the Palestinians. I think, not all, of course. You know, there's many different factions in the Palestinians, in the Palestinian camp also. Just like there's fundamentalistic that we have to fight also in the Palestinian camp, just like we're fighting them in the Israeli side, of course. But I think there's enough Palestinians that can make a change, just like we can make a change on the Israeli side. And these are the people we're working with, and of course they know. They don't have to see the film. They meet us on, you know, they meet us in the hills. You know, we walk into the villages together.
Yeah, but I think sometimes seeing something like this brings it to them. You said yourself that the media will be the way to
reach
people.
And that's part, I agree with you completely, and that's the work we're doing.
Okay.
Yes?
I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about Tayush. I've been in Israel and Palestine a couple of times, and I hadn't heard that name before. That was first in the Fada in 97.
Oh, Tayush is only formed for the second Intifada. Many people in Tayush were in other groups. You know, in the first Intifada, if they were that age to be political then, and many people. The thing is about Tayush is that it's in their actions, like we were watching here. People come from many different groups, some of them that you're probably familiar with. It's more like an umbrella for an action. The why it's successful is because many of the groups have ideologies. You know, some people believe in the two-state solution, some people believe in the one-state solution, others believe in a no-state solution. There's anarchists, there's communists, there's socialists, there's, you know, all, you know, the whole spectrum. And, you know, if they would try to write a manifest, then you end up with a group of 15 people. That's what happens in the Middle East. You know, each 15 people has a group with it, really. But we could all agree on that, you know, if on the action. And then we get together and we could do the action, many, many groups under the umbrella of Ta'ayush. So you might have heard of Bat Shalom, or you heard of Rabbis for Human Rights, or the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, or Gush Shalom, and I could go on and on and on. You'll see all these people. You'd even see them in the movie. You see the people at the action. Maybe sometimes it's sponsored by you. Sometimes all the groups are listed. You know, sometimes it's not. But it's more of a tactic than a.
So it's not a fixed membership in an organization. It's kind of in flux. And my other question is, how is a practical cooperation with the Palestinians, with all the closures and double closures? How do you get together? Which language do you speak? Do you speak Arab yourself?
Okay.
And how often do these actions actually happen? What we see in the movie, is this like once every 6 months, or is this something ongoing all the time?
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as membership in Ta'ayush. It's just like there's no such thing as membership in indie media. You come, I mean, I remember a few people asked me, I only lately became very involved in Ta'ayush. I was doing lots of other things. And people would ask me, are you in Ta'ayush? And at one point I go, I don't know. Wait, I was there last week and the week before and 3 weeks ago. Okay, yeah, I guess I'm a member. You know, I personally choose not to go to the meetings because there's great people doing it. And that, to your next question, how are things arranged? That it's, yes, that Ta'ayush is the, when you talk to people in the territories, it's usually the Arab members of Ta'ayush doing the coordination and getting the stuff done because they're speaking Arabic. So it might even be people, you know.
Arab Israelis or Arab Palestinians?
Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, yes.
Okay.
That's everybody in Ta'ayush has Israeli citizenship. It's an Israeli group.
Okay.
Lots of the members know Arabic. I don't. I'm embarrassed about it. I signed up a few times to a course and never made it. And it's one of the things I'm most ashamed of. I think it really is a problem that I don't. But many have learned in the past years because if you really want to make a difference, you also have to know the language, and that's something that. I say out loud all the time, and then I don't do it myself, so I admit it. What was the last question?
Maybe one more.
Okay. Yes.
I just recently saw on the internet an email from Uri Avnery, who's, I guess, the founder of Gush Shalom, the Peace Bloc, and he expressed some, hope, and a little bit of optimism in the election of Mitzman to be the new labor leader. And he was saying that he's got a sense that there's some kind of change perhaps happening, among the Israeli population. And, he says sooner or later people wake up and realize they have to learn to live in peace. But he thinks that Mitzman, being the, winning the head of the labor now, is a good sign. What's your take on that?
I share his feelings.
Uh-huh.
I was very cynical about Mitzna in the beginning. I said, oh no, another general. And, Israel's the only country with this democratically elected junta. So, and we've been in this, there's a saying in Israel, I've been in this movie already. And that's exactly the feeling, with Barak, a French general coming with great, we saw where that led us. But he made, when he says, if I will be prime minister, I promise in the first year I will take troops and settlements out of Gaza. He said that clear. He wasn't saying peace and security and this and that. He was made a very clear statement. I have to give a lot of respect. I have to give a lot of respect to that. So it does give hope. Also gives hope that if he thought this could help him get elected. So that's really good. If he's running for office and he thinks he makes a statement that he's going to take apart settlements and take troops out of Gaza and that will help him get elected, maybe he shares my optimism about the Israeli public also. So I think that's a good sign. And I'm a little bit less cynical than I was a few months ago when he started running. Yes, in the back?
Do you know why the Israeli public has elected Netanyahu and Sharon, his right-wing people, and apparently intended to do so again?
I do have ideas why this happened. I don't, but of course I ask myself, you know, how could this happen? I think it's a question in many countries why the working class votes for the right wing. I think, you know, it's not that different here. Why, you know, our polls showing that the majority of American people support the war in Iraq. I think it's a deep analysis of what forces were working in on the Oslo Agreement and what kind of globalization forces were working in Israel through the 90s. Why the working class people in Israel felt that this peace is not about them and they're not going to get anything good out of this peace, which is not that different also than the Palestinians, which also didn't get anything out of this peace because the occupation continued. There was a small elite in Israel that was the, I would say even like the spearhead of the global economic forces that they were being used to go into the Middle East, which left a lot of people behind. Israel, which if you look at it 20 years ago, was a pretty equal country between the rich and the poor. Of course, there was always problems, but it's one of the leading countries between how much the difference between rich and poor. I'm talking about the Jewish society. Between how much the highest wages compared to the lowest wages, even in the public sector, could be 15 times as much. And I'm not exaggerating.
Why is that?
Why is that? Because a small group of people control the country and are very happy about it, and they don't want to give up power. Why? And in order to keep the power, they have to tell, with a lot of propaganda, with a lot of force, with controlling the media, and again, we're back to the media, and there's five families in Israel that control over 90% of the media. The biggest newspaper in Israel is the same family that owns the biggest, one of the biggest, there's three big networks. It owns one of the networks. It owns the cable company. It owns half of the financial newspaper.
Sounds just like here.
Yeah, it's just like here.
I don't really know all the facts here. I don't know. I think it might even be worse. Who are these people taking these generals and putting, you know, how do these generals currently appear and, you know, and do campaigns and run for parliament to get elected? Who's giving them the money? Who's pulling the strings?
The rich.
It's not even the rich. You could say names. I could tell you the names. Yeah. But it would mean nothing to you because they're behind the scenes. We don't know them. And these are the people who said, okay, you know, we have to do something to continue business in the early 90s because this intifada that the Palestinians is not really good for business. So why don't we make a deal with Arafat? We'll bring him and his people from Tunis. We'll tell them to oppress, they'll take care of business that the Palestinians won't uprise. And we'll continue this occupation because we have to have this occupation because this is our workforce. I mean, I don't know if any of you read the Oslo Agreement, if you read the Paris Agreement, which was the economical agreement that was signed by the Palestinians after Oslo, saying that they can't open a factory without Israel's permission. And there was no factories opened in the territories. There were small businesses, there was advertising agencies, and they thought, you know, where were the factories being opened? On the borders. There's a read an article the about Oslo, and the headline was workers from Gaza, bosses from Tel Aviv, landlords in the Wall Street. you know. And that's pretty much, you know, Oslo in one sentence. It's not only Gaza, though. It was also in Jordan. I also come from the way I became also very politically aware of what's going on. I was working in environmental issues. And they were building this, there was this, building an industrial park on Jordan River. You know, first of all, you know, it's like, what? Isn't like this one of the holiest places for Christians around the world? Building an industrial park on the Jordan River. Who's supporting it? Who's giving the money? The World Bank. Great. Mm-hmm. Who is this money going to? Who's building the factories there? Victoria's Secret, Gap. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. You know, who they were supplying. Not them, of course, because, you know, they don't really own anything. They just have subcontractors. But we know where the... And so you start looking into it and you say, hey, wait, there's a very good industrial park just 10 kilometers down the road in a city called Beit Sha'an. And it's empty. Why aren't they building it there? Well, first of all, because it's already built, so you can't make money from building. You know, you won't get money from the World Bank to build something that's already built. This town of Beit Sha'an is mostly North African Jews, very high unemployment. But they're not building it there. They want to build it on the Jordan River. Why? Because the Jordanian worker who's living in Ilbid, you could pay him $2 a day. So why not build a factory in Jordan? Because if you build it on Jordanian land, you could have the tag made in Israel. Made in Israel is worth more than made in Jordan. You could sell it for another dollar, $2, or more. And of course, Israel has great trade agreements with the U.S. Jordan doesn't have the trade agreements because we're these great friends. So we have to have the factories in Israel, but we're not going to give work to the Israeli worker because he needs social, because he demands these crazy things like pension and social benefits and holidays off and working, you know, only 8 hours a day. Very spoiled Israeli worker. The Jordanian doesn't demand that because he's under a kingdom, under a regime. And the Palestinian can't, because also the PA wasn't a democratic elected. Well, the Palestinians, though, demanded it. That's why they started the Second Intifada. They weren't willing to be the slaves. Oh, and it's not slaves of Israel. They're not making, you know... Okay, there's a few Israelis that are making good money off of this. But we know really who's making the big money.
Can I ask another question? Please.
Yeah, sure.
I just came from the East, and on our television, I keep on seeing programs where... they are sponsoring raising money for Israeli poor people that are just haven't the means to support themselves there. And I'm kind of confused by the way it's portrayed. We never hear about the Israelis that are not comfortable or that aren't in a good position as far as financially is concerned. Do you have any...
Yes.
Knowledge about that?
Yes, of course. Israel is in a terrible economical situation. I was saying, I might be wrong, but I'm not wrong by a lot. I think it's every fourth Israeli child is under the poverty level. And again, I'm talking about Israelis.
I'm talking about Israelis.
There's a terrible situation in Israel. I'm talking about me. Most of my friends are unemployed. Every other week, I go to a going away party of somebody immigrating. And I'm from the middle class. We got good educations, you know. I'm not, you know, and we're in a good position compared to most of the country. And again, because you know, and we know where the money's going. The money's going to the settlements. The money's going to the military, and the money is going to a very small percentage of, you know, you go. It's amazing. You drive by Tel Aviv. You know, me and my friends, we could barely afford. Luckily, I have a good job. I'm fine. But a lot of my friends can't even afford a beer anymore. It's like they don't even go out. And we see the Jaguars going by. And like, where is this coming from? We know. Yes, there is a small percentage that's making a lot of money, but that's a small. It's a minority. Yes. Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, you said approximately one out of every four. Israeli children is born at or below the poverty line. Do you know what the statistic is for Palestinian children?
Yes. In Gaza, it's I think it's
4 out of 4.
Hmm? Probably four. It's probably 3 out of 4, or 4 out of 5. And also, the poverty line is very much lower in the Palestinian in Palestine. It's a much lower poverty line. It's
so it would be harder to get there, but they're making it.
What?
The being at that low.
Oh, they're much lower. It's right. Much no. Don't understand me. It's much worse in the territories.
Yeah.
You know. Don't. I mean, you can feel sorry for the Israelis, but I agree. It's much worse in the territories. There's no question about it.
Thank you.
Yes.
I was just curious if you could, because it seems like the noticed kind of thing. You could talk a bit about the since the Second Intifada began. I know that lots of workers used to work in factories in Israel who were Palestinian no longer can do that. And so lots of workers have been kind of imported. And I just wonder if you could kind of speak about their conditions, what that's meant for.
Yes, okay.
Thanks.
Just if the question wasn't clear, she was, because of the closure of the territories, the Israeli contractors need workers, and of course they're not going to pay Israelis what they demand. Like I was saying, because they have these crazy demands, so they're importing workers from poor countries like Romania and Ukraine, China, Philippines, in the Chinese situation, it's really worse because it's the deal with the government. The situation now is that a lot of them are leaving because there's not work, but some are already established, and some still it's better than when they're where they're from. Or others can't. There's nowhere for them to go back, like in the situation of the Africans, which come from civil countries in civil war. So there is, of course, not as bad. Surprisingly, not as bad as you would think. But there is, of course, calling. Oh, these people are taking work from the Israeli worker, which is, you know, if you look at Europe, most of the discrimination against. Migrant workers comes from usually from the people, and the government kind of protects them in a way. In Israel, it's exactly the opposite. The government, you know, is really uses as a political thing, you know, to say these immigrant workers are taking work. And surprisingly, most of the Israelis are aware that this is not true. The legal status that if they're that or that they belong to a contractor, and they have to work for him because he gave him the permit, or that they're illegal. So the majority are illegal because they run away from their contractor. So there's quite a few hundred thousand. Nobody's really clear of the numbers. The numbers go everywhere from 200 to 500,000 of what they call illegal workers, or I think the non-documented workers is probably the better term in Israel. Most of them live in the southern neighborhoods of Tel Aviv, which is also where our media center is. So we meet a lot of them. And there are groups working you know, with them and doing stuff. And I mean, I could go on and on, but it's, yeah. Yes?
I think most Americans believe that Oslo would have been a good deal for the Palestinians. Do you agree? And do you think Barack, with his political pressure, could have gone any further? Could he have given more in Oslo?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the first question?
Well, my understanding of Oslo is that it would have left the Palestinians in little islands, population islands, in the West Bank. But I think most Americans think it was a good deal, like it would have represented the whole West Bank. Could Barack have given them a container? No.
I think, obviously, what was offered to them by Barack is better than what they have now. I mean, that's just, you know, a fact. You know, it's better to have a little than nothing. But that's looking, you know, that's, it's kind of like being smart after the fact, in a way, you know, saying, you know, when you gamble, in a way, yeah.
Hindsight. Called hindsight.
Okay. Hindsight?
Hindsight.
Okay. I still don't think, even if they would have accepted, they would have, you know, they would have demanded, they, and rightfully so, they would have demanded more. If Barak could have given, I don't know what the political situation he was, if he could have given a better offer, but he definitely could have created a situation of much more trust by not building, continuing building the settlements, by not blowing up the meetings and saying all or nothing, by going step by step with them, and not, because he wasn't implementing the Oslo Agreement. He didn't do, there were steps he could have done. And he could have built more trust that it wouldn't have exploded. And then, yes, we could have got to a, you know, a step-by-step agreement. But the trust wasn't there, and that's why it exploded. I'd rather, though, not like get into political analysis, because I, what I think is that the, you know, we know what the situation's like on the ground. I don't think it's a secret, especially for the people sitting here in the room. And I think there's enough of that could be agreed on in, you know, in doing work. You know, it's the people are being oppressed and we have to stop it. We have to stop the occupation. And this whole, lots of times, you know, people talk, I mean, it's important to talk about what Barak offered and what the Palestinians did. And did they do a mistake that they agreed or didn't agree? And if Barak was, had, and you could go on what really was, what really happened in Camp David and what happened in Taba and also what happened in 47 when the UN offered something and who refused. And it's important to talk about these things and to be educated. But it doesn't, even if you get to a conclusion that the Palestinians did all the mistakes possible and they had the worst leadership, they still, it's still, you still have to change this, you know, it still shouldn't continue as it is. You know, they shouldn't be punished for bad leadership. And I'm not, and also we have to remember where this leadership came from. Yes?
Well, to follow that line of thought about, you know, looking at the, not looking at the political, just the political completely, or, but so often I've heard about, you know, the politics of it, and the, you know, different agreements. I've heard about the religious conflicts and such. But when you talk about it, I'm hearing a real strong dynamic of more the whole corporate global dynamic that's going on, you know, in Israel. And it puts it in a much clearer perspective. And I was wondering if you could state, you know, some books or some writers, some you know, whether in magazines or whether in books, whatever, you know, after you leave. It would be nice to follow up on that idea.
I just want to make it clear. I mean, there's many aspects. I mean, I'm not saying that the religious and cultural and
They're important.
They exist, but it's okay. Well, which book? Well, first of all, Tanya Reinhardt just came out with a book that I highly recommend. But I think any way you would educate yourself on the economic global forces, then you could then understand how they work in Israel. It's, and this is something that, I mean, we're exactly almost the week of 3 years of the battle in Seattle. There is a very big awareness, I'm sure, in this town of these forces. And you know, it's shocking when you like you read about Argentina, or you read about, you know, the FTAA or agreements. You know, I could almost one by one see how things in the Middle East, it's almost the same. You know, the factories on the Jordan Valley or on Mahzom Erez, which between Gaza and Israel, are not that different than the factories being built on the Mexican border. Yes, so somebody didn't speak yet?
I'm curious about the sort of the way the generational breakdown is in terms of awareness in politics, like you're about 31 years old, and what about your age group? Do you guys vote? I mean, is this going to be who's going to really have the power generationally, since there is that issue in Israel that's so strong, the generational differences. How do you see that in this next election coming up?
I don't really see a generational thing.
You don't? Okay.
I think it's, I was in a Palestinian town a few weeks ago, month and a half ago, called Yanun. We were doing, we were protecting it from settlers that were doing, harassing the villagers there. So we were sleeping there at night, because they would think twice before harassing Israelis, especially Israelis with access to the media. And we have very good access. And I came back the next day, you know, I had to go back to work. And in the car with me was an 18-year-old kid that the next day was supposed to go into the army and refused, and he knew he was going to spend a long time in jail. And a 70-year-old man who, and you know, the three of us went, and it didn't look strange to me. Obviously, you know, in my circles, I'm more or less with people around my age. The video here each piece was edited by somebody else, but the person who put it together, a 90-year-old kid who also refused going to the army, doing his public service in indie media. Not recognized by the state, of course, but he's volunteered. You know, he said, I didn't go to the army, I'm going to volunteer doing that. By the way, which is, he's living in Scotland now. After a year and a half, he had it too much. He had to get away.
What's the voting age?
But, you know, there's a woman, Chava Kelev, that works a lot with us. She's a Holocaust survivor. Probably in her late 80s. Comes to every action. Stands in Women in Black every Friday. We had an activist camp of doing direct action, like trainings, in some like desert area. I saw her coming. She wanted to climb the ropes. I mean, it's but what you don't have is really, I think, what you're missing is pretty much in between the early 30s and the people who are in pension. That's pretty much is what is missing. You know, it's from very young till pretty much depending on people who start, if they start a family or not. And then people who, like, maybe their kids left the house. And then a lot of them might be coming with their teenage kids. But all the years in between, that's what you're missing, and for pretty obvious reasons, because people are busy, you know, building their family. And also maybe they're in much more fear when they have young kids to be hurt themselves, you know. It's dangerous going to the territories. So, you know, but, you know. Yes?
I was wondering, you were saying you didn't want to dwell too much in the past. I was wondering if you could dwell a little bit on the future about what might happen if we attack Iraq, what effect that will have.
It's scary. It's very, very scary. You know, in the first Gulf War, missiles fell on Israel. And luckily, we had a prime minister that can make any decisions, which was usually bad when you have a prime minister that can't. But when he's in the Likud, you're very happy that it's a prime minister that can't make any decisions. And we were very lucky. I was in the military then. I remember sitting at night on the helicopters when we got the order, you're going to Iraq. I remember that night so clearly that we, with all our stuff, and we get into these big Sikorskis. In the beginning, everybody's laughing and making jokes and all that, and you know, the hour goes by, and the next hour goes by, and then, you know, 3 a.m, nobody's talking anymore. You see everybody's looking at each other. Nobody's falling asleep either. Everybody's looking at each other in the eye, and then you start, it dawns upon you, you know, who won't come back, or how will you come back? And like around 4:30, 4:45, the sun starts coming up, and we know we're not going to fly in the light. If we'd fly, we'd fly dark. And this feeling of joy, just, nobody said it, but just, you know, that we were, and you had the biggest machos and right-wing people and everything. But sitting in that helicopter with everybody, nobody opened their mouth. Nobody was joking anymore. And just the joy when the sun came up in the morning. And they said, okay, you could go back to the base and, you know, clean up your equipment and go to sleep. Later on, I read some books. I know what happened. There were planes in the air. My helicopters weren't. There were planes of friends of mine, the paratroopers. They were already in the air. And they were told to go back. You know, I thank God that happened. You know, big deal. So missiles fell on Tel Aviv. You know, that's not going to happen with this government. Could the Iraqis? Do they really have weapons? Will they really shoot at Tel Aviv? I have no idea. I don't think, I don't know who knows, you know, and if we know, will the government, if a missile falls on Tel Aviv and a few thousand people die, I don't want to even think of how Sharon and his gang would take advantage of that situation, and how, I almost don't want to think about it. I think we just have to be very prepared. I don't know if we'll have the power to stop if something like that happens, to stop anything. But, of course, I'd rather that there wouldn't be a war in Iraq. It scares me a lot. No. Even though it also scares me when Saddam Hussein's around my neighborhood. Yes, it does scare me also. But, Saddam Hussein, it's in my neighborhood. Oh. That scares me. I'm not saying, you know, but it's... But right now, I'd rather leave him, you know, I'd rather leave the bully alone. Yes?
Who are the settlers?
My question goes right
away. Okay.
For me, it seems like the only real hope for lasting peace is the settlements getting out of the West Bank. And is there any hope for removing the settlements? And what is what percentage of population supports the settlers in Israel?
When you talk about the settlers, it has to be very clear who you're talking about.
Yeah, who?
The majority of the people living in settlements wouldn't even call themselves settlers. There are people who went there because they got a very good deal. They wanted to have a bigger apartment or a house with land, you know, not living in Jerusalem in a 1.5 room, you know, on the 14th floor of some, you know, projects. That's what you call them here. Yeah. That's the majority. When they were shooting on Gilo, people went out and they said, why are they shooting at us? And when people said, you know that you're in the West Bank, you know, you're a settlement, they go, no, we're not. We're a neighborhood of Jerusalem. A lot of people knew, some people were just lied to. And that's most of the neighborhoods around Jerusalem. People didn't know. A lot of people knew, but they said, hey, the government said it's okay. You know, and I have an uncle who's living in a settlement. He knew. He knew where he was going, but he still, you know, when he says, but, oh, I just wanted a nice house in the suburbs. And I believe the majority of the settlers, if they feel there's a true democratic decision, they'll accept it. Of course they'll be asked to be compensated. Yeah, what's it called, the word?
Compensated,
yeah. But, you know, they don't want a civil war in Israel. They don't want... But we have a very small percentage who are not in these economic settlements, in these neighborhoods. They're in the outposts. They're in these small ones. They're in the ones in the hills. And they're the problem. They're armed and they're dangerous, even though they're not a lot. And their children are usually more radical than they are. And there's a whole generation. Some of the economic settlers, their children already become the ideological settlers.
Religious.
Yeah, most of them are religious. Some don't even recognize the state. They say it's between me and God. This God gave me this land. What kind of state? Which state could tell me where I could live? You know, and what the Israeli public? I think the the Israeli public doesn't like these ideological settlers. They have a real problem. They have a lot of compassion for the economic settlers. I think most Israelis understand the mistake of the settlements. But they also, the hate that comes out of their fear to the Palestinians almost doesn't let them express their how much their disagreement with the settlers. But I've had discussions with so many people, like, oh, come on, but you know, like, deep down inside, what do you think? And I think one of the things that what was managed to do in the olive harvest was, again, the settlers, or a lot of the kids of the settlers, these teenage kids, like skinheads, they kind of passed the line and they started really, like, shooting at people harvesting olives. Mm. And that really did a big uproar in the Israeli public. You know, there's certain lines that, you know, the Israeli public, even though it was Palestinians, weren't willing to accept. Of course, when they were also shooting at Israelis, or nobody cared about the internationals, but there was a big uproar. I think the olive harvest was a successful campaign. You had at one point, you know, you were able to see a shift in the Israeli media. Not that they started liking, that the public started liking the Palestinians, but they started hating the settlers. So, yeah.
I have flyers this color on the table put out by the U.S. campaign to end the occupation. There's a national Jewish group called Junity, a coalition of, you know, Jews working to end the occupation. This sheet is about transfer, and what it's saying is, you know, that there apparently are Israeli academics, you know, people who are warning that there may be, you know, a movement, you know, to transfer the Palestinians, you know, out of the territories, and this tells, you know, how to resist that, who to write, etc. What do you think? Is that a possibility now?
Yes, there's always the possibility. I would never say about anything in the area that there's not a possibility, first of all. And I'm not saying this as, you know, to be witty. I mean it. But I don't think the Israeli public would accept a visible transfer, meaning they would see people being put on the trucks and sent. I think there would be a public uproar. I don't think at the moment, and this could change, the Israeli public would accept it. What they are accepting is the day-to-day slow transfer. You know, the middle class in Palestine is disappearing because the situation is so bad, whoever could get out gets out. I mean, it's also working against it because a lot of Israeli middle class are leaving also, but that's a different story. People are, you know, It's this day-to-day bureaucracy that is making people leave. It's not a visible transfer. It's, you know, like in these cave dwellers that we're watching, few people here, a few people here. This is because it's a firing zone. This is for security reason. Here we need this. Nobody's saying it's a transfer. That is what's happening. That's the real danger. And that's what we have to wear. We have to call it transfer. We have to point it and say, this is transfer. Because nobody's ever going to say, there's not going to be trucks that say transfer, you know, load on the truck. That's not going to happen. And if we're going to, you know, I think you have to also be very careful of crying wolf. You know, because everybody's like waiting for the trucks. And then they're not noticing the slow transfer that's happening. You know, there's no concentration camps. You know, there's no trucks that are loading people on and taking them to the desert. But there is a slowly day-to-day humiliation and oppression and, you know, these little things that you could give each one an excuse. This roadblock we need here. And this one, and this one, and this one. And that's why we have to, you know, you have to be very careful not to, you know, to point at really what it is, and fight against it, but not give it these. At the other hand, you know, go too far, so you could be very easily dismissed. And I think it's something that I feel that it's a danger. And you know, I think it's a lot of mistakes also the Palestinians do. You're like Jenin, they cry massacre, massacre, massacre. And then people say, oh, only 60 people died, only 100 people died. It wasn't a massacre, because they said 600 people died. So, you know, so it's bad enough what happened. Jenin is terrible what happened there. So let's talk about what happened there. Let's not make... But if you say 600 people died, it's now, what are you talking about? So it's... We have to be very, very careful. Because there's enough things we could point at and try to stop and change. So I understand the Palestinian fear, saying this fear, this transfer. I live in the Israeli public. I think it's a true fear. We have to be prepared for it. But you know, it's like no. Let's not all wait for the trucks. Yes.
I'm curious how friends, family, who are. More on the right relate to your doing this work.
I had a time last year that my father asked me how it feels to be a traitor, and I didn't talk to him for like a month. But you know, now we're in a very good relationship, and not only that, I send him stuff sometimes to proofread. And he's like, I think you should write here anti-corporate, not anti-capitalist. Because, you know, like, he totally doesn't agree with it, but he's like... I mean, with parents, I think, and family, if you're honest, you know, and you're not, again, doing this demagogue, you know, genocide, this, that, of course nobody would speak to me. But when you... You know, spell things out, and you go things. And it's not only honesty, it's not, you know, a lot of times, you know, in our, people would say, there was a sign in the office once that said, collecting clothes or food, canned food or whatever, and then three kids from the neighborhood walk up and they go, well, why are you collecting food for the Palestinians? We go, because, you know, they need it. And did you collect food for the poor people in the south, in south of Israel, where the poor towns are, you know, where... They're also starting kids, and they go, oh, you weren't here last week? We collected food for the poor people down south. And suddenly they were like, whoa, you know. Now, that wasn't true. But it could have been true. You know? because we are honest. They know we could have, they couldn't say, no, you never collected food for poor people. There was in the neighborhood, they wanted to close down one of the, like a medical care for single mothers, for poor mothers. And why they want to close down? Because there's budget cuts. Why are there budget cuts? Because we know all the money's going to the territories, because there's a war going on. We have to cut the health care. We, with many mothers, some drug abusing, some... You know, having, you know, different children from different fathers. You know, pretty much what I think they call here welfare mothers or something like that. We went on this, we fought with them not to close this. There's nobody in Indy Media was in need of this medical center. But we fought, and some people got arrested, blowing up, taking over council meetings, city council meetings. But you know, when they were sitting in, you know, then they started asking, hey, but what are you doing? And why do you love the Arabs? And we're like, we don't love the Arabs. We're fighting for justice. Like we, and you know, we, two of our best writers now in the magazine are those mothers. Two women who, because, yeah, they were like, okay, you're right. And they're writing things like, I understand a Palestinian mother that this is something that I didn't want to print, but she wrote, I understand a Palestinian mother that is lets her son put on a suicide bomb and goes to blow up herself. I didn't want to print that, because I don't understand, but...
Did you print?
And what?
Did you print?
We did.
And what was the response?
Well, they expect everything from us now. I mean, we have our responses, but again, I think because we're honest, because we also write about the health system, because we also write about education. You know, we write about the environment. I think, you know, when we moved into the neighborhood, people said our office is going to be burned in a week. We were there for 2 years and we don't put on the alarm. I mean, we're there. We're you know, we're part of the society. And we're also, you know, just like, so maybe, you know, when we came, a lot of us were, you know, came from more wealthier neighborhoods. But it, there's not that difference anymore because everybody's unemployed now. Everybody's
I'm going to take this moment to interrupt to talk about collecting, so that seemed like an appropriate time to come up here with this. I'm going to pass this around, and whatever you can give, this will help Ronan with his expenses, you know, for getting up here from San Francisco and for, you know, his traveling around the country and going back.
And if you get more, we can make more videos.
We're going to make checks out too, Jerry.
To him, Ronan Edelman, E-I-D-E-L-M-A-N.
Yes.
Do you have some thoughts about what it might take to get Hamas and other radical groups to engage in the ceasefire?
Yes, but I just remembered something I wanted to say about the other question, but I will answer that. Just to end the thing about family and friends, I do have to admit that there are... be honest and say there are places that I just rather shut up. Like in my, I'm working at a certain place for a year. So the people working me in the same floor, they all know, and they're good friends, and they also give very big support. You know, like when I'm working on my computer or another on indie media stuff, and they kind of like cover for me, and they're kind of like, oh, we're really happy you're doing that because it makes our conscience feel good also. You know, they're not doing anything, but they're covering for me. But there were other people on other floors of the building that I just didn't let them know because I just didn't want to deal with it. I said, you know, when I go to work, I don't want to get into political arguments. And then at one point it came out. And, you know, one of them calls me Al-Qaeda, whatever. But you know what? It came out at the end. We got into this big argument and cursing. 2 days later, they forgot we're back in work, you know. We're working together, you know. And I also working with them, even though I know that some of them are fascists. That's what it's like. But there was a question here about the Hamas. You know, just like I feel we have to make it very clear of the dangers of the corporate capital rule of the world, we have to make it very clear also the dangers of the fundamentalistic right of the religions, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, all, there's a lot of this. And it's, but it's, there's a situation that is on the ground that lets the Hamas or the Jihad exploit the situation for their ideology. Now, they won't disappear. And even if, when there will be this perfect world, when everybody in the Middle East will be equals, I think there will still be a fundamentalistic Islam, there will still be terrorism. It's not going to disappear. But we have to take away this, what is the word, this like,
incentive.
This growing ground for the exploitation of people to these ideas. We have, you know, if this happens because, you know, you could say, this, and one of them is occupation. Okay, let's take occupation away. Okay, it happens because of poverty. Let's take our poverty. You know, you could take, it happens because of misunderstanding of the Quran. Then, okay, we have to deal with it that way. You know, there's many ways, but, you know, but if there's something that we know that obviously is creating the problem, maybe it's not the only reason, but let's do away with that. But yes, there's no magic. There's no magic here. The fundamentalism of Islam will be there, and we're gonna have to deal with it. But let's deal with it with a real answer. Not deal with it with buy more like here or, you know, fundamentalistic Judaism like in Israel or by occupation. Let's deal with it with real answers. of, you know, with our values, with our what we believe in.
Just to follow up on that, you were mentioning fundamentalist Judaism, Orthodox Judaism. What I hear is that this becoming an increasing problem, like in Jerusalem, and that some Israelis are actually worried that the already divided Israeli society is becoming even more divided between the, what you call, fundamentalist Judaism or Orthodox Judaism and the non-religious population. In other words, is Israel going to be a democracy or a theocracy 20 years from now?
I think it's the same answer I gave about the Hamas. Why is groups like Shas or ultra-Orthodox group able to exploit? Why so many people that are not even religious vote supporting them? Because they feel nobody else is representing them. Nobody else is giving them answers. You know, they say, you know, or be, you know, a Western consumer, you know, or, you know, and work for, you know, 70 hours a day for, you know, I'm sounding so simplistic, you know, it's not that simple, but, you know, I can't really give the example, but, or be this, or be this, and we have to create a third way of building a community, you know, where people take care of each other, not like, you know, because the answer that the forces supposedly fighting the fundamentalism is giving are not answers that people could accept. Yes?
Kind of following what you said, I think one reason a lot of people in this country don't engage in this issue is because it's kind of framed in the mainstream media as if you have to choose between Israeli security and Palestinian freedom. And like your introduction was stated, they're actually linked. But kind of Israeli security and Palestinian freedom. And I'm wondering if you, having been here for like a month or so, how long have you been here?
3 weeks.
If you have any other insights or ways to maybe try to engage the American public, being that we go a long ways toward making this the application possible with our tax dollars.
I mean, the answer, the best answer, I have a change your system here. That's really
what
it.
About, because, like a shorter-term goal?
Right. You know, I feel like I don't really feel comfortable in this position. I've been asked many times already this question. I feel really uncomfortable in this position. I mean, you know it here much better than we do. Yes, of course. You know, there's no reason why U.S. taxpayers should support the occupation. Stop it. Yes, of course. I mean, it's not much more I can say to that.
So I think it's about time to let Ronan get some rest. And there is coffee back there. There's no hummus, but there's coffee. And I wanted to say a couple of things. You know, after we thank Ronan.